This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. We like to remember people whose lives made a difference. Dennis Beck has a proposal to do just that. His Wall of Honor would take advantage of the proliferation of indoor digital billboards to publicly acknowledge such people. He sat down with Prairie Pulse host John Harris to talk about his nonprofit Wall of Honor.
Dennis, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, John. Thank you so much for having us.
Well, as we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background, maybe.
I grew up in a town in Linton, North Dakota, and I joined the Army National Guard in 1987 to be a combat engineer. Went off to Fort Leonard Wood to train and basically serve the community, the country. I was a combat engineer. Ended up going to college on the Montgomery GI Bill, which many people are aware of, and got my degree. After completing my college career and while serving in the Guard, I got asked to become a full-time recruiter for the National Guard. So I continued to do that on and off for the next 21 years. And I retired from the Army National Guard in 2011. And since then, I've basically been serving or doing landman work for the state of North Dakota in various oil and gas, solar, wind. Married to my lovely wife, Jane, and we have three wonderful kids. Devin's, who's a junior at University of Mary. Dylan is a freshman at University of North Texas, and Lauren's a freshman at Legacy High School in Bismarck. So,
oh, all right, and thank you for your service. What is the Wall of Honor?
Well, what the Wall of Honor is, it's an electronic billboard that is placed in restaurants, bars, veterans organizations, airports, hotels, just about anywhere that the public is going to see and basically be aware of what's going on. And what the Wall of Honor does, it recognizes or honors veterans, active military, retirees, first responders, our police officers, firefighters, basically any person out there that is basically giving to their community, their country, and selfless service. We want to recognize that and make sure that the people are aware of, you know, these volunteers or these service people out there.
Who started it, or how did it get started?
Well, it was a brainchild of a Vietnam vet who remembers coming home, and they weren't very well received and very well appreciated back in those days when they returned from service. And he's done fairly well as a businessman in his life, and he decided that about a year ago, he said, we need to start something to basically show appreciation and do this. So he basically started the seed money to get this off the ground and get it started.
Okay, well, he provided the money, but who provided the work?
Well, we've got a number of volunteers that basically go around and you know, solicit sites or ask if they want to be. We've got Dave Weiler, who is, a real estate agent out of Bismarck, who's, you know, good at marketing and has a lot of contacts. And we've got myself as the Veterans Liaison Officer. I work with the veterans organizations, try to establish, some places that we can be. We've also got Major General Mike Haugen, who is our national or state spokesperson. And he has been instrumental in getting us into the Fargo Airport and as well as other businesses here in the Fargo area. So we're very pleased that he's, stepped up and taken part of this. And basically, we've got a full-time marketing person who's on, salary that we're, paying. And then we have a part-time temp marketing person that will have come in. If the honorees are, uploaded or there's a lot of them being, we have to usually bring somebody in part-time. So that's sort of how we are making it now or how we're going. And
how does it work in terms of who can get a wall, I guess, a wall named after them?
You go to thewalloffhonor.org, and that's where you can basically nominate an honoree. And on that form, you'll download a picture, you'll put in their years of service, what branch they served, maybe what ribbons, awards they got, like Purple Heart, etc. And you'll also put their military history, and then you'll put a point of contact. Our marketing people, when that's submitted, our marketing people take that information and they create a slide. And it's a slide, basically with their branch of service. And then within 48 hours, that's on every monitor that we choose to be on throughout the state of North Dakota.
Are these people that are no longer with us, or can they be living to get on the wall?
Yeah, basically it's anybody who's ever served that has roots or ties to North Dakota. So it'd be veterans, retirees, it's active military. We've even started a recent program where we're taking like new people that have joined the service, and we're doing a little slide on them, like what their hometown is or where they're from. And then what we're doing with like first responders, let's say we get a sponsor, an advertiser that basically wants to advertise in a region, we'll say, you know, so-and-so bank is proud to sponsor the, you know, the Fargo Police Department. And then we'll have a slide like that on there to recognize the first responders and the local service people in the area or the region.
Okay. Where are the billboards currently, and where can they be set up?
Okay, so currently the billboards are throughout North Dakota. We've got approximately 30 locations right now, and they vary from restaurants, bars, taverns to we've got some in the Fargo Airport. We've got many in the veterans organizations like the AMVETS and the Legions. They can be practically anywhere. It just depends on you know, where they should be and where they're going to get the most you know, public awareness.
Mm-hmm. Is there a fee to establish this, or?
Well, basically the cost of installing one is about $1,500, and that would be for the monitor, the marketing, and the play box that has to be digitized or, you know, set up. And then after that, there's about a $35 a month fee that we pay to keep the box active throughout. And what's unique about these boxes, they're serial numbered. So if I have a digital box in a bar in, let's say, Castleton, and they want to advertise, they advertise on their box, but the other box in Castleton would be unique and it wouldn't necessarily have that advertisement. So we can create that separate advertisements and keep that distinct for each area.
What's been the reaction so far to this?
Oh, it's been very positive. You know, we've put it in a few taverns, and the tavern owners have said that their business has increased because of it. They say people come in every Monday or every week to see if there's any new honorees, and they want to see if Uncle Joe got up there, you know, things like that. So it's been very good. And we've actually gotten calls from, you know, if somebody sees one when they're on the road in a bar or restaurant, they'll call us and say, how do we get one? And so it's been a really, really cool thing to be a part of.
Yeah. With that said, though, how long do they stay up? I mean,
they stay up indefinitely. As long as we have funding and as long as we're able to basically finance the project, we sign a contract usually for 1, 2, or 3 years just so we have some kind of contract. And the policy is that they got to be on during business hours. Mm-hmm. And of course, they can only be used to show the Wall of Honor. It can't be used for any other means because, you know, it's something that you want to protect and make sure is used the right way. Mm-hmm. So there's really no limit to it. As long as we have financing and we can stay funded, they'll stay up indefinitely.
Well, now you said, are they all electronic?
They're all electronic, yes.
Okay, correct. So you can change or add to them pretty easily.
Yeah, actually, we upload somebody within 48 hours, and every Monday we have a refresh or a new playlist that comes out on every single box. And that's because of our marketing team.
Yeah. Well, so how do you see this growing? You mentioned a little bit, people wanting, asking you for them, but I know you want a lot of different people to get the recognition.
Yeah, and so what's interesting about the Wall of Honor, what we do is we will take the honorees and like within a 50 to 70 mile radius, we'll make sure that those veterans or those military people stay on that box all the time. And that represents about 50% of the playlist. And then we sprinkle in the other veterans and the other military retirees from throughout the state. So we are always changing our content, but the local people always stay constant because that's important for us to make sure that the community can see their local people.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, I understand some other states have found out about this and expressed an interest? Are people contacting you from other states?
Yes. So interestingly enough, by being in these veterans organizations, we get people that travel through the state of North Dakota, obviously. And one of them stopped at a veterans organization, the AMVETS, All Vets and Steel, and they saw it. And within a week, we were called and said, this is the greatest thing we've ever seen. And he's an American Legion member. And so we're working with the state of Wisconsin and the state of South Dakota to possibly enter into an agreement with them to get the Wall of Honor started there.
Now, the way I understand it, the vets, first responders are honored regionally. So if you're sitting in Castleton, that electronic billboard or wall will be different than if you're in Williston or if you're in Grand Forks.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. So the regional sponsors or the regional honorees stay consistent, and then we change out the other half every week. But, you know, what's nice about it is somebody in Castleton, even though they have their local content, occasionally they'll see a member or an honoree from Williston or Bowman because of we changing those out. So,
what about hospitals, waiting rooms? Wouldn't they be perfect spots, or have you looked for other spots to put these?
Yeah, so right now, Major General Haugen got us into Fargo Hector Airport, which is phenomenal. It's a great location. We are in talks with the other airports to see if we can get in there because we think that's a great audience. We are actually in talk with hospitals and clinics to see if we can get into some of their waiting rooms. And what you run into is, of course, you run into protocol. You run into advertising issues and what can be on these screens. So we're working through some of those. But anywhere that we can be, we want to be, as long as the public can see it.
What do they look like? I mean, is it a TV-type monitor? What is it?
So what we've been doing is we'll go out to a site and we figure out the location, what they can fit, what they can host. And usually what we do is our standard install is about a 55-inch TV is what's pretty standard. And what we do then is we go back and we sort of work with marketing to make sure we get the local content or the local heroes on there. We'll have them create some slides with the police department, the fire department, et cetera, on there. And then what we'll do is we have a box. It's a small box about like an Apple TV box or Roku or whatever. And that gets loaded on there. And then we take the TV, the EasyAd box and everything out to the site and we do the installation. And then the minute we have it up, it's up and running. We hook it up to the internet and it's capable of receiving live feeds. And usually what we do in return for that business hosting, we'll put on like some advertising for them. If they have a Thursday special or if they have something for Veterans Day that they want to do, we'll put that on there for them.
Mm-hmm. Are you able to do this remotely? Are you tied into it?
Actually, our marketing person has her laptop, our computer back at the office, and she can actually see if they're up and running, and she can like change out the slides instantaneously on the run. As long as we're hooked up to their internet, mm-hmm. it can be done like that. So.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. What are projects like this, the Wall of Honor, and even things like the Vietnam, the Korean War, and the World War II Memorial in Washington do for veterans?
Well, it's a sense of pride. It's, a lot of times it's selfless service. It's they don't ask for much. And when they have these things put up in their honor or they can see their fellow soldiers that were maybe KIA or whatever, it's just a sense of pride and a sense of, you know, I did this for my country, I did this for my family, I did this for my community, and this allows us to have a better place to live. So it's very appreciated.
And then what do things like that do in terms of outreach and, of course, sharing the knowledge that to the young and to the more experienced,
yeah,
the seasoned people?
Yeah, so what the Wall of Honor does is, like, we'll have a special week maybe for Veterans Day, where we just do something for Veterans Day the whole week, and it's a special slide that our marketing people put together. And like, you know, December 7th for Pearl Harbor Day, we'll run a special feature for then, and Memorial Day. And the other thing we do through our Wall of Honor is we'll do like pro bono or free advertising to the American Legion or the AMBETS. If they want to try to recruit young military people into their organizations, we try to assist them with that and try to gain membership to make sure that we can keep that going so that we can have our color guard and our honor guard and we can provide a proper funeral and burial for veterans. So those are some of the secondary missions that we have.
Yeah. Can you tell us the story of a veteran or first responder maybe that you didn't know anything about until you got involved with this Wall of Honor?
We had a Wall of Honor installed at the Bismarck Elks. And we were told of a story where a lady was sitting with a man, And she noticed the Wall of Honor, and she seen the veterans, she seen the slides, she seen everything that was coming across, and she stated, well, this is really neat. What a wonderful way to honor our first responders and veterans. And then all of a sudden, the slide with Cody Holte came across the screen. And unbeknownst to a bystander, tears started rolling down her eyes. And of course, it was very moving, and she was very appreciative. And she said to this gentleman that this is the most wonderful way I could ever imagine to honor my brother. And so that was really something that, you know, made us believe, or we knew that this is making a difference and this is the right thing to do.
Wow.
So,
what are the goals for the Wall of Honor for the future?
Well, the goals going forward would be we want to be at 100 locations by the end of 2021, and we want to grow by 100 additional locations 2022 and 2023. And so that's that long-term goal. And the other thing we want to be able to do, if we get to that point, we want to be able to directly help the veterans organizations across the state to make sure that they can stay open and stay there for our veterans so they can have a fellowship and have a place to go where they can, you know, basically be in a place.
Well, Dennis, if people want to get involved or want more information, where can they go?
Best place to go is thewallofhonor.org. It's a wonderful website, and you know, it's a great place to donate. It's a great place to advertise, be a sponsor, upload honorees. If you know somebody that served that you want to get on there, please submit them. And we try to have them up there within 48 hours.
Dennis, we're out of time, but good luck and thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, John.
That was Dennis Beck in a conversation with Prairie Public's John Harris. The entire conversation and all Prairie Pulse TV episodes are available on Prairie Public's YouTube channel. Next on Main Street, another episode from Telltale, Dakota Folklife and Stories.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them. In Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. And by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative, and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Telltale, Dakota Folklife and Stories, is a collection of narratives describing the shared personal experiences and lore of the North Dakota Plains. The stories originate from interviews with senior citizens, many of whom are in elder care facilities. Today we have an episode titled A Line on the Floor. It's about a time when people with a particular communicable disease were sent to sanitariums.
Human beings have suffered from tuberculosis since ancient times. In Europe during the 1800s, it was responsible for nearly 25% of all deaths. TB has had many names, including Lunger's disease and the Great White Plague. In America in the 1800s, it was most commonly known as consumption. Tuberculosis most commonly occurs in the lungs. It's an infectious disease, and it's contagious. But because of advances in medicine, particularly in antibiotics, it's no longer the threat to humans that it was, but it's still a deadly disease. The cure for TB in the pre-antibiotic era was a regimen of rest, fresh air, sunshine, and good nutrition. The first sanitarium built to house and treat patients using these methods was constructed in New York in 1884. The first and only sanitarium built in North Dakota opened in 1912 and was named San Haven. Carol entered San Haven as a patient in 1963.
My earliest childhood memory was I got tuberculosis back in the early 60s. In 1963, I was only 2 years old then. And my uncle got tuberculosis and ended up, our whole family ended up with tuberculosis, everyone except my dad. So it was me and my mom and my two brothers and my uncle. And so we spent close to a year, around 9 months, I believe, in San Haven in the tuberculosis sanitarium by Dunseith. And that's my earliest childhood memories.
Carol's memories of her time at San Haven are few, but she does remember some things very clearly.
I was a baby. I was in the nursery area. So I was basically separated from my family. And I think that's my earliest childhood memory, was trying to find my mom and being taken care of by nurses and things like that. And my two brothers, who were 10 and 11 years older than me, so they were 12 and 13 years old, packed a pillowcase with boxes of cereal and fruit and ran away because they didn't like it. They wanted to go home. So they went tooling down the road, and one of the doctors on his way to work saw them and picked them up and brought them back. So they didn't make it very far, but they had intentions of running away from there.
But Carol's strongest memories are those of being separated from her mother.
My mom had a different strain and a more severe case of tuberculosis than I did, so contact would have potentially infected me as well with the strain that she had. There was a line on the floor, and I remember that I couldn't go past the line, and then my mom had a line over there so I could get as close to the line as possible and lean over and talk to my mama, but I couldn't reach her, and I remember being really upset and scared about that.
She also remembers a couple of very kind nurses who called her Dolly.
There was a couple of nurses there that I really took to, and the nurses would sometimes take me across the hall and let me hold my mama's hand for a little while, but I could never really have a lot of physical contact with her. And so that was probably the hardest part. And because I was a baby, there wasn't a whole lot of babies in there, but since I was a baby, that, well, 3 years old, baby to them, the nurses really took good care of me, and there was a couple that I had as favorites, and I still have cards and letters in my memory book from some of the nurses that would write to me, and they called me Dolly. So I have letters that were addressed to Dear Dolly, we sure miss you, and things like that.
Today, Carol is stoic about what most of us would now refer to as a traumatic childhood experience.
And because I had a different strain, my brothers and my mom were hospitalized longer than I was. So then I had to go home alone and be taken care of by a grandma that I didn't know. It's an interesting story from my childhood.
The San Haven Sanitarium, located near Dunseith, North Dakota, closed in 1987. Its many buildings are now abandoned to the elements, slowly decaying and falling to ruin. Produced in partnership with the Cheyenne Care Center in Valley City, North Dakota, and Dakota Legacy, this project is supported in part by a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts, which receives funding from the North Dakota State Legislature and the National Endowment for the Arts.
That's narrator David Swenson of Mokoche Studios in Bismarck, where Telltale is produced. Coming up on Main Street, Bill Thomas has a story to share too, and we'll hear about an upcoming production of Henrik Ibsen's classic play, A Doll's House. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The North Dakota House plans to take action tomorrow on the complaints against Dickinson Republican Representative Luke Simons. Simons has been accused of threatening and sexually harassing women at the state capitol. Last week, top GOP leaders called on Simons to resign. He has refused, denying the charges. House Majority Leader Chet Pollard told the House the plan is to convene as a committee of the whole at 1 o'clock Central tomorrow. Pollard said he expects every member to be participating either in person or remotely.
I don't want to do this, but if there are folks missing, I will have a call of the House.
And Pollard said that will be the only agenda item for that session.
We have a duty as legislators, and so however long it takes tomorrow, that's what we will be doing.
Simons has hired an attorney, and an online fundraiser has been established for his potential legal fees. The House narrowly passed a resolution declaring that North Dakota will obey only the federal laws, rules, and executive orders the state deems to be constitutional. The measure is more generally known as a nullification measure. Findlay Republican Representative Bill Devlin argued this would violate the Constitution's Supremacy Clause and said only the courts can determine the constitutionality of the laws, rules, and orders.
This isn't nullification. This is wishful thinking, and we do not have this power.
The measure passed 46-45. Since it is only a resolution and not a constitutional amendment, it could pass with a majority of those present and not the constitutional majority, which would be 48. And the price of natural gas spiked last month thanks to the cold spell in the southern U.S. North Dakota's natural gas providers saw the spikes and will have to pass them on to consumers. But the North Dakota Public Service Commission has opened an investigation into those price spikes. Here's Commissioner Brian Crotius.
Our job is to take a look at mitigating the impacts to the extent we can from a balanced billing standpoint and spreading those costs out so consumers aren't experiencing sticker shock on any particular bill.
Crosha says by doing that, the average monthly impact of the price spikes will be a lot less than having the whole cost hit all at once.
Just being cognizant of those, especially on fixed incomes, to get that in one large chunk would put some undue pressure on them.
Crosha says natural gas facilities in Texas, for example, were not winterized like they are here in North Dakota. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
I'm Dave Thompson. North Dakota lawmakers have returned from their crossover break, and they have a lot of work ahead of them. On this week's Legislative Review, we'll talk to Bismarck Democratic Senator Erin Olban about the big issues still facing the legislature, as well as her caucus's priorities going forward. Legislative Review, Friday at 6:30 p.m. Central on radio, and also available on our digital platforms.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Little Stories is a series of reports from the North Dakota Council on the Arts about groups that have been able to adapt during this time of disruption. We'd like to share one with you. This story is read by our Bill Thomas.
You may not have heard of the North Dakota Council on the Arts Art for Life program, unless maybe you or someone you know goes to a senior center or lives in some kind of senior home or facility. Art for Life started more than 20 years ago, and it was a bit of a trailblazer in this kind of work, which work is, to quote the Arts Council, to improve the emotional and physical health and wellness of elders in care facilities, as well as those living independently, through intensive art and artist interaction. Now, you may be thinking of a watercolor class or a musician coming in for a concert. It can be more, quite a bit more. I was talking to Alicia Glynn, who is a manager with Senior Facilities in Ellendale. I was talking to her about one Art for Life project that they had there, and I asked her if that one was a one-off.
No, Ellendale has a pretty amazing, it's called the Ellendale Area Arts Foundation or Council, and they sponsor things year-round. They are always coming up with something new, exciting. They've done many things. They brought in many artists. I know at the other facility, they had pictures that they brought in from this artist that were hung throughout all the hallways. They've done giant scenes in our chapel that were, you know, 15 feet high by 12 feet wide. They're always bringing in new and different ideas for us. This was just an added bonus.
Yeah, as you've probably heard, the coronavirus pandemic has hit seniors hard in North Dakota and elsewhere. They might have canceled the Art for Life programs. Instead, well, hey, they're artists. They got creative. Here is a report about how artist Melissa Gordon performed in Ellendale in Dickey County, south of Jamestown, and Watford City in Oil Country. This is Alicia Underlee-Nelson.
Artist Melissa Gordon kneels on the sidewalk outside Evergreen Place in assisted living in Ellendale, patiently pressing great swaths of green and goldenrod into the pavement. Some residents watch from the windows. Others sport protective masks and monitor Gordon's progress from a safe distance. Under their watchful eyes, a pastoral scene featuring a big red barn and a pair of tow-headed kids in candy apple cowboy boots emerges. The image resonated deeply with the viewers. Many spent most of their lives on farms and ranches, and the drawing brought back memories. They had requested the images in Gordon's artwork, but the final product was a surprise.
Everybody was talking about it, how excited they were, says Cindy Glynn, a registered nurse at Evergreen Place. They kept checking in. It gave them a lot of joy to go out and see something that's outside the norm, especially given the quarantine. Gordon's vibrant chalk drawings also grace Prince of Peace Care Center in Ellendale and Good Shepherd Home in Watford City. At Prince of Peace, delicate pink and purple blossoms, yellow hearts, and words of encouragement spill across the sidewalks that usher residents to a popular outdoor courtyard. At Good Shepherd, she created personalized chalk marker drawings directly on residents' windows. The projects look different since they're based on residents' requests, but they share a common purpose. All three facilities use their Art for Life grants from North Dakota Council on the Arts to cultivate connections and a sense of community for seniors during the time of coronavirus.
Socialization is such a big part of their day, so to maintain those guidelines of social distance, but also keep them engaged with their families and each other, has definitely been a challenge,
explains Alicia Glynn, Evergreen Place housing manager.
It was something to talk to their families about, and it was neat for them to share that connection with each other as well.
The projects also gave residents a chance to recall some of their favorite memories. Gordon, who is perhaps best known for her portrait of Sitting Bull in the Bismarck Art Alley, said that she particularly enjoyed transforming each resident's memory into a unique work of window art. There's a whole story in each room, Gordon says, that triggers another memory, and they're able to communicate and share some of those stories. These individual works of art set off a flurry of conversations between staff, residents, and family members who viewed the images from outside the building. The images depicted are as diverse as the residents themselves. It might have been their favorite flower or bird, a flag in honor of their military service, a story of them spending time in the Badlands, a picture of their barn on their farmstead, or a picture of the logo of the business they used to work at with their spouse, says Kristen Rohn, activity director at Good Shepherd Home. They were all so unique. Those connections, conversations, and memories are a vital part of the service that long-term care facilities provide. During times of social distancing, they're more important than ever. By doing art programming with our residents, we are able to fight the loneliness, helplessness, and boredom which can often be associated with those living in nursing homes, says Rohn. Art helps us take care of the resident as a whole and helps us honor them, mind, body, and soul. This is Alicia Underly-Nelson for Prairie Public.
Thank you, Alicia, for that reporting. Now, you may recall a little earlier I was talking to another Alicia, Alicia Glenn, who manages elder care and senior facilities in Ellendale. And, you know, I just had to ask her, like, how's it going?
We have really, I am the manager over at our basic care and assisted living. So it's been a little bit different for us. They have a little more freedom over here. And our skilled nursing facility across town has, you know, we were doing really well for a long time. We did have the virus end up getting into our facilities. And so, like we talked about, it's just been difficult because for them to be together and socialize is just, it's what they do. And when that virus is so prevalent in your county, which for us, unfortunately, it was, we were the second worst county in the nation for a while. And when it's bad in your county and in your town, it's bad in your facility. And it's been a challenge to how do we keep them safe without, you know, losing their minds because they really want to get out and visit and see everybody. So the art on the windows, that was another thing she did. She did these huge art scenes. We've had people come on windows and do art scenes. People play games through their windows with their grandchildren. I've never seen so much love and creativity from our community to help us get through this, because it's been a challenge.
I've never seen so much love and creativity, she says. Well, it's great that Art for Life can be part of that. You can see lots more about this and other projects. You can go to prairiepublic.org, Little Stories, or arts.nd.gov. That's arts.nd.gov for more on all sorts of art-related things in North Dakota. This project is supported in part by a grant from the North Dakota Council on the Arts, which receives funding from the state legislature and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Bill Thomas.
Next, we'll hear about a free theater performance from Capital Shakespeare.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
When they lay me down someday, my soul will rise.
The greatest thing that's ever happened to me is my family. Oh, man, I wouldn't be nothing without them. Family is first. The music business comes way after that somewhere.
When I was a child, I cried.
I got through it, and hell no, I'm not sitting back.
Watch Loretta Lynn, My Story in My Words, tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and I'm joined now by Kaylee Stanger. She has a lead role in an upcoming production of A Doll's House by Capital Shakespeare in Bismarck, and she joins us to talk about the play, the role, and getting ready for performance during a pandemic. Kaylee, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about yourself first. Who is Kaylee Stanger?
Well, I am a student at UMary right now. I'm a comm major and a theater minor. I'm from Fargo before. Went to Shanley High School, but now I live in Mandan.
And what's your career aspiration? What do you want to be when you're done at UMary?
I'm really interested in production things. I'm a media production track for communication. And so I'm really interested in like behind the scenes as well as acting. So hopefully I'll stay in some type of production thing.
So it sounds like you're interested in being a producer.
Oh, maybe.
Okay. Do you know why Capital Shakespeare chose to stage this Henrik Ibsen play, A Doll's House?
I know our director really just fell in love with it when she first read it. And I know Dakota Stage is also doing Doll's House Part 2, so they kind of collaborated a little bit on this. But otherwise, yeah, it's just something that I know the director really, really enjoyed.
Well, Henrik Ibsen made quite a splash when A Doll's House was first produced in 1879. It's based on a true story of a person he knew, and the circumstances of that story are well represented in the play. But how would you tell the story of A Doll's House to somebody who asks you, what's this about?
Well, it's kind of the story of basically Nora, who I'm playing. She's living a life just sort of trapped kind of in her daily routine. And when she does something out of the ordinary for any young woman of the time, it puts a strain on her marriage with Torvald. And throughout the play, she just comes to realize new things about herself and new things about her family and her marriage. And it's this growth from being trapped and being seen as a doll to who she really is as a person.
And that's the significance of the title, A Doll's House. She is somebody else's kind of possession, if you will, and has to do what she's told. At least that's the assumption. She doesn't necessarily do that. How do you research and prepare for a role like this? Because this is a period play. It's an important play. It has big ideas. How did you get ready for this?
Well, just reading through the play the first time, just finding the things that I kind of connected with Nora. I can relate to her kind of journey to try and figure out who she is as a person, because she's really just doing that for the first time, it seems like, in the play. And like, as a college student, you know, everyone in college is still trying to figure out who they are and where they want to go. And so I kind of related with her on that part, which made playing her a little bit easier.
But this is a 19th century play. Are the costumes representative of that? Is the display of manners on stage? Did you look into that kind of thing?
Yeah, we have our costume designer, Michelle. She did amazing work with all the costumes. They're in the Victorian era style. I love my costume so much. They're so fun. But yeah, we had occasionally our director would point out if we accidentally, if we would say a line wrong and throw in some kind of modernization of it, how we'd say like gonna or something. And then we'd be like, nope, that's not right. They didn't say that. So just kind of being more careful about getting the language right, because the way that we might say something now is definitely not what they would say then.
When Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen's play, A Doll's House, was first produced, it was very controversial. Does it still have relevance?
I think it does still have relevance. It's very much about finding who you are and finding your own empowerment and realizing what you need to be able to do for yourself too. Like, taking care of other people is very important, but if you ignore yourself entirely, you end up being an empty shell. And so I think it's really important for people to realize that you need to know who you are and know how to take care of yourself before you're able to take care of other people.
Kaylee Stanger is playing the role of Nora in Capital Shakespeare's annual winter production, and this year it's A Doll's House by Henrik Ibsen. It will be performing at 7 o'clock on March 5th and 6th and 2 p.m. on March 7th, that's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, at the Russell Reed Auditorium and the North Dakota Heritage Center and State Museum. It's free for all ages, but donations will be accepted. And tell us about rehearsing this play in a time of pandemic, Kaylee.
We have been wearing masks in rehearsal. Our director was able to get some that had a clear plastic front so that we could at least see each other's faces a little bit more, which was really, really helpful. But yeah, we just started being able to do a little bit less, like with dress rehearsals, since the actors won't be wearing masks on stage, even though the audience is encouraged to. So yeah, we've just been making sure that we keep ourselves safe and healthy outside of rehearsal too, making sure we're being smart so that we can keep our castmates safe as well.
Yeah, be a problem if somebody came down. That kind of puts the show on hold.
Yeah.
You can find out about the play and about tickets and about, attending at capitalshakespeare.org. This play has some stuff that was scandalous, again, in the 19th century. There's a dance in the play that Nora performs. She does something provocative with a silk stocking. How do you make these as shocking in the 21st century as they were in the 19th?
Well, some of it is maybe a little less shocking. The dance we don't necessarily make super shocking. And then the silk stocking part is, I think it is more of a joke. Like, it's kind of hard to make that not seem funny now, because it is, oh my goodness, not the stockings. It's just not something that people really think about now. And so it is kind of played up a little bit more in a joking manner. But we find other places that show maybe a little bit more shocking things.
Torvald and Nora Helmer are middle-class Norwegians. He's in the banking business, and she's a housewife. They're playing their roles. But it gets a little complicated. The plot is a little complex in terms of who's done something wrong and who feels wronged. And in the kind of an interesting sense, Nora and the antagonist in the play, who's Krogstad, an employee of Torvald's at the bank, are both guilty of the same crime. What I'm getting at is that Nora has this incredible guilt because of something that she did, and she did it for the best of reasons.
Yes.
She actually forged her father's signature on a banknote in order to pay for a trip to Italy when her husband was ill to help him get better.
Yes.
And yet, that would ruin his reputation if it were known.
Yeah, and that's very much part of the journey that Nora goes through, is trying to figure out if what she did was really wrong, because she doesn't think it should be wrong.
Again, this is a play that's been out there for 140 years, so I'm not giving anything away. It has a very famous last scene, and it was so controversial at the time that it was rewritten for some productions. Does it still resonate?
Yes, I think it really does. It's a very big moment for Nora. And I mean, it is a big moment for Torvald too, obviously, but it's where she really takes her life into her own hands and chooses to not be controlled anymore.
This has sometimes been described as a feminist play. I think Henrik Ibsen might have taken issue with that, but nevertheless, it's often cast as that because Nora is demonstrating her newfound independence. She's discovering herself and leaving the doll's house, if you will. What's the approach that Capital Shakespeare is bringing to this play? Is it a feminist play or is it something else?
I think that it could. It definitely is feminist in my view. I feel like it is an empowerment of women in general. Just being able to take charge of your own life and being able to having the ability to say, I know what I'm thinking and I want to be able to say that without feeling like I'm going to be shut down because of it by somebody else.
Now, you touched on this a bit, but it sounds like it's a really heavy play. It's Norwegian. It's Henrik Ibsen. You know, it's been translated from that language and many others. But there's some comedy in it, too.
Especially in the beginning, Nora is very, very bubbly, very just out there. And there's definitely moments, especially when she's with her two friends, when they're just goofing around and having a good time. And so, yeah, there's definitely some comedic moments, too, to help lighten the mood a little bit.
The show is called A Doll's House. It, again, is going to be staged Friday through Sunday at the Russell Reed Auditorium in the North Dakota Heritage Center. The evening performance is Friday and Saturday at 7 p.m., and then there's a 2 p.m. matinee on Sunday. That's a lot of preparation, Kaylee, for three performances.
Yeah.
Tell us about the other members of your cast.
Well, Torvald is played by Austin. He's been with Capital Shakespeare before, I believe. And the only person that I actually knew going into this show was Jeff Young. He's playing Krogstad. And so that's been a lot of fun to get to work with him on stage. But everyone in the cast is so kind and just very supportive of each other. And honestly, everyone has been so fun to work with. Sometimes it's hard to get through scenes because we're laughing too much during some rehearsals, especially our Dr. Rank, Rob. He's very funny. He does something different every single night, and I have to try not to laugh. So it's definitely a really great time on stage.
And Dr. Rank has romantic notions about Nora and a very dark and serious problem that he deals with, and he doesn't quite get all the way through the play, I don't think. Kaylee Stanger is playing Nora Helmer in A Doll's House, Henrik Ibsen's classic play. It's being put on by Capital Shakespeare. You can find out more information at capitalshakespeare.org. Kaylee, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
English folklore has a warning for the people of Britain.
Should the ravens leave the Tower of London, it will crumble into dust and a great harm will befall your kingdom.
The tourism industry is trying to hang on.
If you're in the tour business, every 10 years you're going to have a really bad year.
And what's it going to take to get us on the road again?
The hot term in travel right now is vaccine passport.
Hear it on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 3rd. The General Allotment Act of 1887 made Native Americans individual landowners. The act stated that the head of each family would receive 160 acres of tribal land and each single person would receive 80 acres. Reservation lands not allotted to Native Americans were to be sold to the United States and subsequently opened for homesteading. Proceeds from the land sales were to be placed in trust and used by the government as an account for supplies provided to Indian people. 4 years later, the Executive Order of 1891 approved the allotment of the Fort Berthold Reservation, which began in 1894. In 1901, it was argued that the tribes on the Fort Berthold Reservation didn't have enough financial solvency, so it was suggested
that a 12-mile-wide strip of land on the north side of the reservation be sold, along with another 200,000 acres on the west. On this date in 1901, Congress passed a law that employed multiple special agents to visit reservations and negotiate sales of whatever land Congress declared surplus. Veteran agent James McLaughlin came to Fort Berthold in June of 1902. He told the three tribes that they should sell 315,000 acres, which they opposed. Eventually, they agreed to sell 208,000 acres at $1.25 per acre, which would provide farming equipment, with funds also going to individuals. The proposal was submitted to Congress, but was never ratified. Congress introduced a new bill to open reservation land for settlement, but the tribes rejected it since the government hadn't gotten their consent. Eventually, the Act of June 1, 1910, said that every tribal member should receive 160 acres of farming land or 320 acres of grazing land above previous allotments, along with the appraised values rather than flat sums. While this was supposed to be a victory, many felt anxious with the reservation shrinking into a thin strip along the river. The loss of tribal lands has been a source of sorrow, made worse as more land was taken as the Garrison Dam flooded 156,000 acres of tribal land. More recently, in December of 2016, the Interior Department and the Army Corps returned 25,000 acres acquired for the project to the three affiliated tribes. Tribal Chairman Mark Fox said, "The return of these lands is an important step toward mending a historic injustice." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Andrew Bird and Jimbo Mathis became famous as members of the swing jazz band Squirrel Nut Zippers. They also became really good friends.
We live in very different environments, yet we kind of complete each other in a way.
Now they've reunited on a new album.
We have the same soul and the same heartbeat, just my songs and just my friend. It's a blessing to me.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show archived as a podcast at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, Prairie Public's television service now carries the Indian Country Today newscast. Mark Trahant, a former journalism professor at UND and a frequent commentator on our show, is the editor and now anchor of Indian Country Today. We'll talk about covering Native issues for a wider audience. And Sue Balcom will drop by for Main Street Eats. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.